This is the homily for the sixth Sunday in Ordinary Time, 2023, at St. Anselm's Abbey. The readings for the day's Mass were the Wisdom of Ben Sirach, chapter 15, verses 15 to 20, the first letter of St. Paul to the Corinthians, chapter 2, verses 6 to 10, and the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 5, verses 17 to 37. The homilist was Father Gabriel Myers.
The Sermon on the Mount is important, but dare I say, not particularly pleasant. Today we have some of the most severe, harsh, and guilt-engendering passages in the New Testament. Every soul, every sensitive soul with any self-awareness, will see in his or her examen of conscience how far short he or she falls by sins of the heart. This is helpful in countering our idea that external observance of law and custom is enough, but it is ruthless in requiring of us purity of intention, and quite a few serious souls get crushed by the ideal. Elsewhere, Jesus criticizes the religious authorities for laying heavy religious burdens and not lifting a finger to relieve them. Here, Jesus seems guilty of the same thing. Centuries of scrupulosity in the confessional and fear of hell had their source in these passages about plucking out your eye and God's supposed intolerance for unintegrated places in the heart. It seems unhelpful to me that the Sermon on the Mount lacks context. As the greatest teacher the world has ever seen, and I believe he was, Jesus must have been more like Socrates. He did not stand behind a podium or up there on the mountain and hold forth for hours, loving the sound of his own voice. He must have brought out the many disparate insights that are collected in chapters 5, 6, and 7 of Matthew from many different occasions. A question would come up. Jesus would ask the disciple a question in return. There was dialogue. Education comes from the Latin ex ducare, leading forth. The good teacher knows that you do not get people to learn by shoving things into the pupil's small head. You draw forth from your pupil, an insight from what the learner already knows. Then the truth will be owned and remembered in a way far different from, here is a list of rules, memorize them. Don't let me see you break one. Through the centuries, the official church has held forth on a great many issues, which I suppose, in some centuries, was the right procedure. Someone had to decide that Jesus was fully divine and fully human. But on many dogmas, there has not been much room for dialogue, and dissenters have been brutally dealt with, sometimes exterminated for their own good. Pope Francis's idea of a synod directed by synodality, which is sort of a stupid word, is a start in a different direction. It may be too little, too late. And of course, the rigorous are fighting him fiercely, abhorring the democratizing tendency. But I have to believe that synodality is the mode Jesus would take if he were here today. We all have things to learn, even the greatest authorities in the church. And we gain most when we learn together. It is a messy process, but the best way to have something stick is by listening to others, not just holding forth, and encouraging dialogue. The mountain in Scripture is a symbolic place for the source of ultimate truth, and that, of course, is why Matthew puts this huge collection on top of a mountain. That is why Moses went up Sinai. Though more important than the propositional truths he brought down on stone tablets, was the encounter with God that made his face shine. The story is initially rather spoiled by his ruthless anger over the golden calf, which perhaps is a symbol of the trouble people can get in when they do not have a leader. It is a nasty episode, but does give a fresh start after the calf is melted down and the stone tablets smashed. Moses goes up the mountain again. He has more to learn. Is melting the calf down and smashing the tablets really the way children or adults learn something they will love? Is it not more likely that when Moses came down a second time, leaving his anger behind, that people said, "Wow, your face is so bright. I want that kind of face. What did you learn up there? How can I get that glow?" In an age when so many of us have unmanageable anxiety and take medication for it, Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount gives metaphors about surrendering our insecurity. This, I admit, does not solve the problem. But his statements do take the issue seriously in its spiritual dimension, so that Jesus Christ, taking seriously what wears you down every day, could possibly make a difference in how you see yourself and interpret your experience. Of course, he took his material from what was right at hand. It was simple material. On the ground where he stood, from the tree nearby, which was pouring forth melody. On anxiety, consider the birds of the air. They don't have jobs or get paychecks or plan for their retirement, yet God feeds them. Consider the lilies of the field, which neither fret nor run around. Yet Solomon, in all his fine dress, was not arrayed like one of these. Granted, we do have to hold down jobs for many years. We must plan for retirement and have insurance. But the idea of joyful birds singing, of wildflowers springing up with fragrance and color, shows that human life is not utilitarian. Unlike the lower animals, however dignified they are, we are meant, as well as for work, for pleasure, joy, beauty, simply being our unique selves, blooming where we are planted. This is as important as, or perhaps more important than, what we, like factories, can produce. Another wonderful passage of the Sermon on the Mount addresses the effort we spend in looking good, getting respect, winning applause. We hear this in the Gospel. We hear every single Ash Wednesday. Don't practice your piety in showy ways that will win approval. That is not authentic. It is not what God sees. When you do a good deed, don't blow your horn or try to get attention. Do it secretly. Only the one being helped needs to know. A charming human interest story in a recent Washington Post told of a small southern town, or maybe it was Midwestern, I can't remember, where a secret benefactor paid at the local pharmacy for prescriptions that his neighbors could not afford. Only after his death did the source of this generosity come out when he could not be thanked. But he could be remembered with love, and that may be better. When you pray, and this would be significant in monasteries where we often judge on outward appearance, go into your chamber, not the front of the church. Speak freely to God in the secret places of your heart, and then you may have the stillness to hear an answer. But don't go blabbing it then to all and sundry. If you make a sacrifice, either by money or letting someone else take credit for what you've done, don't insist on your rights. Let people keep their delusions. You don't need their recognition, because being noticed by God will expand your soul sufficiently. The greatest part of the Sermon on the Mount, I think we'd all agree, is the Beatitudes right at the beginning. We hear them every single All Saints Day, and at some funerals. Note that unlike Luke, whose gospel I usually much prefer, Matthew's version has no woes. Pay attention, those of us who emphasize the negative. No woes. In many ways, all nine Beatitudes say the very same thing. Namely, there is a human quality, and each of you are capable of using it. It is already inside you, which makes you happy and makes you godlike. It allows you to rejoice even in hard times, even when you are persecuted. And we know that you don't have to be sent to jail or burned at the stake to endure cruelty and violence, which happens in the best of homes. My favorite beatitude is blessed are the meek, which is sometimes translated blessed are the humble, blessed are the gentle. These are the people who seem to get walked over because they don't push or insist or claw their way up the ladder at others' expense. The great reversal is that they, according to Jesus, will inherit the earth. Now, who needs planet Earth with all its problems to be happy? A little patch of ground in which to love and die is enough for anybody. Inheriting the earth probably means living on our little patch of ground as if you are already in heaven. The first reading today pairs the intertestamental book Sirach with Jesus' approach in the Sermon on the Mount. Most of Sirach, I admit, I sleep through. But at chapter 44, I always wake up, even though, sadly, it is never read at Sunday Mass, and only in a little snippet on the memorial of Joachim and Anne on a weekday in July. Sirach chapter 44 is to me suggestive of the Beatitudes. It is a eulogy. Eulogy comes from the Greek word for praise, eulogia, and praise need not just come after death. Here it is. Let us now praise the famous ones, the heroes and heroines who made a mark in their generation. Some of these governed and had power. Some made judgments and pursued scholarship. Some composed music, and some wrote poetry. Some shared their wealth with others. These are the obvious ones for fame. But some, and here comes Jesus' great insight, some have no lasting memorial. They have disappeared from memory as though they had never lived, as if they had never been born. And now comes the inheriting the earth part. These two who are forgotten did beautiful things, and in silent, invisible ways, what they leave behind will be preserved. Their bodies were buried in peace, and the congregation, that is us, who didn't really know them, unknowingly proclaims their praise, their eulogia. This thing of being someone who's forgotten, yet having given something, is an ideal to be lived for, I think. Not that we gain superficial recognition, but the profound recognition that only God can give, even when our bodies crumble into dust.